This is the Communication Research Podcast, a production of the Communication Research Center at Boston University. For information about the podcast and other activities of the Communication Research Center, please go to www.bu.edu/com/crc. In this episode, we have an interview with Assistant Professor Deborah Jaramillo of Boston University. The topic is her book, Ugly War, Pretty Package.
Hello. Thank you again for tuning into the Communication Research Podcast. This is episode 4 in our podcast series produced by the Communication Research Center at Boston University. My name is Jim Shanahan. I'm a professor of communication, also a member of the Communication Research Center. And with us today is another member of the Comm Research Center, Deborah Jaramillo. And welcome, Deb.
Thank you. Hi. Nice to be here.
Very nice to have you, Deb. You are an assistant professor in the Department of Film and Television, and your area of specialty is television studies. And you and I are both new here. It's our first semester. So how's your semester going?
Fabulously.
How do you like Boston?
It's great.
Boston is great. I've been here a long time. I was here a long time ago and love the city. And we're recording here today on December 16th, so I'm going to call this our holiday episode. So happy holidays to all of our listeners. We're here today to talk about Deb's book. The title of the book is Ugly War, Pretty Package, How CNN and Fox News Made the Invasion of Iraq High Concept, published by Indiana University Press. We'll give more information on the book at the end of the podcast. So, Deb, this book, I've gone through it, is a very interesting examination of really the very first few days of the war and the news coverage of it on CNN and Fox. So, in a few words, can you give us a summary of the research you did to produce this book and the essential conclusions that you reached?
Sure. I focused, as you said, on the first 5 days, actually, of the war. I chose those particular days because that's when you have the most intensive round-the-clock war coverage. And for the first few days, there are actually no commercials. So it's very, very interesting to see how commercial television works without those breaks that are very logically inserted into the news stories. So I chose CNN and Fox in particular instead of something like MSNBC or the news networks because I did want that 24-hour intensity, but I also chose those two because they have the most well-defined brands. MSNBC tends to waver quite a bit at the moment. It's trying to be left-leaning.
Right.
So
less so at that point, and it's
yes.
And it's yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And so CNN obviously, still have MSNBC is rising actually, but at the time CNN and Fox News were the ratings leaders, basically, with a very strong opposition to each other, at least discursively. So essentially what I did is I watched about 240 hours of news and transcribed everything, not just for the language, but also to get the images and sounds and when the commercials came back on to understand what was going on in terms of the interaction between the quote-unquote text of the news itself and the advertisements, because there was an interesting exchange that was going on there. And in terms of conclusions, I determined that in not only in terms of language, but in terms of images and sounds and marketing and all of these other things, the war coverage exhibited signs of high concept, which is a term that we'll discuss in a bit. Mm-hmm. But it was this interesting flow from kind of Hollywood production values and narrative values and Hollywood marketing as well, a flow of that over to television and specifically television news. So one of the actually really interesting things was that Fox News and CNN, though they both exhibited these signs of high concept, they went about them in different ways in accordance with their specific brands, essentially.
Right. So I guess we ought to get into that term. That's obviously the high concept, the organizing principle of your book. Reading through the book, you see it's a notion that comes from the world of film. So for listeners not familiar with a high concept film, let's say, or anything high concept in the world of media, what does that mean?
Well, high concept has kind of different meanings depending on who you're talking to. Justin Wyatt has a great book called High Concept, in which he traces it historically. And basically what he's arguing is that it started out in television, actually, with the made-for-TV movie. And the idea that, you know, you needed to be able to pitch this thing in 25 words or less. It could be easily summarized in TV Guide, et cetera. But the way everyone typically thinks about it is coming from Hollywood. Now, in the 60s and early 70s, Hollywood was in an economic crisis, basically, and this was why we had such amazing movies coming out at the time. You had great, the so-called Hollywood art cinema and youth filmmaking and all of these kinds of things. And then we get Jaws, right, and we get Star Wars, and we get these films that lend themselves very, very easily to marketing and merchandising. They have, you know, narratives that can be easily summed up. And so that kind of snowballed once they, you know, found this formula. And so into the 80s, you get films like Top Gun, right, where you have a very, very, you know, a great poster, right? You have Tom Cruise and Kelly McGillis and I think a jet in the background. From the poster, you understand the film, right? And then you have the song.
Do you not even need to see the film, really?
Exactly. And then you have the song that ties into it. And, you know, with...
And what was the song that I'm trying to remember?
Oh, gosh, it was...
We'll remember later.
Yes, and then it'll be in my head all day.
Yeah.
With films like Flashdance, for instance, you know, you have the great...
What a feeling. I do remember that song.
And Footloose and, you know, American Gigolo with its fantastic poster, actually, which is a little more complicated than the Top Gun poster.
Mm-hmm.
But it's heavily stylized, and that's one of the key components of high concept. Justin Wyatt sums it up as the look, the hook, and the book. These films have... a seamless integration between the integration of the actual style of the film within the film itself, within the marketing, and these things go hand in hand so that one reinforces the other. You have the marketing hooks, all right. You have the songs, you have the posters, you have all of these things that again very easily reference the film. The film references the marketing. Everything works in concert. And then you have the text itself, which is supposed to be, or the book, that's supposed to be, again, easily understood, so it can be easily sold, easily consumed over and over and over again. And when you consume one thing, it reinforces the consumption of another thing. So it's actually a brilliant system. It's a brilliant system of packaging. I mean, one of the best examples is Batman, the original Tim Burton Batman. Mm-hmm. The logo was pre-sold, obviously, coming from comic books. The idea of a pre-sold product is really, really vital here. So you have the logo. That's all you need to have on the poster because everyone is aware of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
You had the Prince soundtrack that went with it. And then you had the Inspired By soundtrack that went with it, right? You had all of the clothing that stemmed from it. I mean, I remember the marketing and merchandising blitz that surrounded Batman at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the very sleek, heavily stylized look of the film in and of itself. So that, I think, is probably the best example of what high concept
is. Yeah, you know, Tim Burton, to underline your point, my family and I were in New York, and there's an exhibit... And I think the Museum of Modern Art on Tim Burton,
really?
Yeah, so with, you know, look is obviously a big part of what he does. And so my family told me that was a very interesting exhibit. And the concept, the notion of hook, I know that from popular music as well, too, where, you know, producers are, I think, loath to we're loath to produce a single if it didn't have a hook, you know, a single, you know, guitar line or something like that that would essentially hook the listener in this case.
Mm-hmm. And let me just add that, I mean, obviously, you know, films have had these components separately for a very long time, right? And, you know, one of the reasons that Hollywood really took off with high concept was because they borrowed from the marketing techniques of the B movies of the 50s, basically, the very flashy posters, the idea of just selling the idea of the film before you even had a script, right? But what really facilitated the development of high concept was conglomeration, actually. So we need to consider the industrial circumstances of these films as well. The idea that you had a parent company that could exploit all angles of the film, basically, within its own holding. So it's, I believe Ted Turner calls it chopping up the chicken, basically, where you use every single part of this text. You take advantage
He's
of it.
He's interested in sustainability.
Absolutely. Southern wisdom.
Right. Well, I mean, there is that stereotype of the network executive or the studio executive, you know, hearing the pitch, where if it can't be framed as, well, you know, this is Brady Bunch meets Mad Men, you know, or something like that. Mm-hmm. They need that. Is that kind of what we're talking about, high concept?
And if you're talking about just the narrative, absolutely. And in the book, I talk about that opening scene of The Player, which is just so amazing, where, you know, Out of Africa meets Pretty Woman, you know, et cetera. Yeah. So that gets to the heart of the way in which the narrative must be very, very simple to understand, very, very simple to communicate.
Well, I was going to ask you that then. Would it be an oversimplification to say that high concept really means narrative simplification married to, I guess, advanced but simple graphics and with the hook part is, you know, the way political candidates these days are told to stay on message, right? Do you think film producers and television producers are really behaving in the same way so that...
I would argue yes, although I wouldn't say that the look and the graphics are simple.
Right.
They can be exceedingly complicated, but the point is that they're striking. They're not dull in any sense. They really do grab you.
So they should be stylistically comprehensible in some way, shape, or form. Mm-hmm. So that's interesting. And so essentially you're arguing this notion of high concept that we've just talked about here is applicable to both CNN's and Fox News's coverage of the war. So as you said, you were really looking at the first 5 days of the war. Correct me if I get any of this wrong. March 19th to the 24th. This is, as most of your listeners will remember, in 2003, the actual invasion. You looked at 200 plus hours of coverage. And you said that you were really looking at five variables in your analysis, the graphics and animations that were used, titles and text crawls, things like that, commercials when they came on the scene, and then studio coverage, in-studio coverage, and also expert commentary. It's a lot to take in all at once, I'm sure. And of course, mostly as viewers, we take it in all at once without much attention to any specific aspect. So how were you able to, or how did you go about, disentangling and then perhaps reconnecting these various components in the process of your analysis?
It was a really interesting emotional experience, actually, to obviously watch it, you know, the first time around. Well, the way I watch news, I typically surf. I hop back and forth between CNN and MSNBC. Fox News, not so much. but when I started the process, I actually started out with CNN, watching, you know, every single thing I could get my hands on. And that was... I was doing that in a public setting. Actually, I was doing most of those in one of the archives. It's at the College of Communication at the University of Texas at Austin. So it was a different way to watch news, because typically you watch news at home, unless you're sitting in a bar, in which case you're not really listening to the news, actually. You're just watching it. So that was just kind of straightforward, watching with other people around me, transcribing everything, and just kind of, like you said, taking it all in at once. With Fox News, it was slightly different. I was watching all of those tapes in Mexico, actually, where I was writing, and screaming at the top of my lungs in anger at some points. But, you know, it's just an entirely different kind of viewing, because you have to constantly rewind. I wasn't relying on transcripts that might have been available through LexisNexis or anything. This was all, you know, done by hand, and so... it was in the process of rewinding and transcribing and even doing animations on my own so I could remember exactly what I was looking at. You know, I was deconstructing at that moment, because every time I rewound, I was looking at something different. So it was very obviously, you know, much different than an average type of viewing. And then based on that, It was literally rereading and indexing, and it just the kind of, you know, grunt work that you have to do to pick everything apart like that. So it was an interesting kind of balance of emotion and then subsequent detachment from the incredible violence of the coverage.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, I've done, pardon me, I've done content analysis myself, and it is very, well, it's just draining work. And when I've done coding myself, you know, I had all those experiences you had lots of times, you know, had teams of coders with me. Even then, it's an enormous amount of work. And particularly if you're looking at something with such a high level of emotional impact as the first days of the invasion obviously had. So in doing that, if we were to take a broad swipe at this at first, how did you see the idea of high con? Well, let me put it to you this way: as you were watching the coverage, I presume you started without a predefined hypothesis or research question. Is that correct?
Yes.
Right. So, at what point did it occur to you that, as you were watching the coverage and doing analysis and so forth, that the notion of high concept would be an interesting and valid way to organize and make sense of it?
It was actually the kind of discovery process came in two phases, really. The first was I literally was clueless about what I was going to do my dissertation on.
Right.
I went into the program thinking I was going to do one thing, and then really my PhD experience was marked by two big moments. One was September 11th, which happened 3 weeks into my PhD program,
wow.
And then the war
in
2003. And so that happened, and that completely shifted my priorities. And I was watching the news like everyone else, trying to make sense of what I was seeing. And it was literally, I was just listening to a guest lecture one day. I don't even remember where I was, somewhere on the UT campus. And obviously not listening to the lecture, but thinking about all the news that I had been watching. And I realized that, you know, the way that the news was being packaged was very, very similar to this idea of high concept filmmaking. And I realized I wanted to explore that more. So I went in, obviously, thinking about high concept, but once I actually started watching the coverage and transcribing and then coding, it's almost as though the book wrote itself. The examples just kept coming, and they kept getting a bit more severe as the days wore on, the days of the coverage wore on. And one of the things that I didn't intend on doing going in was to compare CNN and Fox News. I didn't want to argue that one was doing something that the other wasn't. That was something that just came out naturally. So the idea that CNN actually clung to what the Department of Defense was putting out, while Fox News, you know, pushed it further to the extent of ignoring the DOD at sometimes and going even more extreme with their conclusions and their speculations, was something that I absolutely did not think that I would find. I wasn't looking for it in any way, and it just came out of the coverage and the analysis, really.
Well, that's interesting, and that was, you sort of answered one of my questions, which is now in 2009, and you mentioned the ideological positioning of MSNBC as well. The three major cable news networks have tried to sort themselves sort themselves along an ideological continuum, and that was, I think, evident, I'm sure, obviously to you in 2003 as well, before the arrival of Fox News, less so, and CNN more on its own. I think now viewers would, or listeners, viewers, excuse me, of CNN and Fox would have no problem thinking that their coverage might be very different if that same invasion were to occur today.
Mm-hmm.
But less so then, don't you think? I mean,
yeah, it seems that, you know, it has to do with the way that Fox entered the scene and the way that everyone reacted to Fox. You know, CNN reacted in trying to make itself more centrist,
mm-hmm.
at the time in opposition to Fox's, you know, very obvious leanings. And now, as MSNBC has drifted to the left, or to its idea of the left, CNN has actually drifted rightward, even though Lou Dobbs is now gone. Right. It's gotten to the point where CNN and Fox News are essentially saying the same things in the same way, you know, to the extent that, you know, when the big Tea Party protest, the Glenn Beck thing happened in September, Fox News accused CNN of not covering that protest, of ignoring it. And so CNN, in an effort to, prove how much it was like Fox News, ran an entire montage of all the coverage that they did. And so, you know, it's very interesting how Fox has this tremendous effect on everything around it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, and you deal with lots of, I think, underlying explanations for that throughout your book, all of which would be too many to talk about here. Of course, the ideas of media ownership, institutional factors, concentration of ownership, and so forth, do play a big role in your book in relation to High Concept. So I assume here you're arguing a sort of an economic driver for a High Concept approach, right?
Absolutely. I mean, the bottom line with High Concept filmmaking is the money, absolutely, and the efficiency with which a conglomerate can exploit, as I said, all kind of components of the film, you know, the text itself, the marketing and the merchandising, the ancillary markets, et cetera. And so, you know, news has been in a kind of economic crisis for a couple decades now. And, you know, in cable news, obviously the game is much different than in network news. Mm-hmm. The amount of eyeballs they're getting tends to be different. And plus, they have a 24-hour cycle versus just, you know, a half-hour program. So, you know, absolutely, we need to focus on, at some level, you know, how they're going to bring in the eyeballs to attract the advertisers, how the cable networks are going to make money.
Right. That's the other thing I wanted to just bring up before we move on to the rest of the book is, you know, here in 2009, we're dealing with two wars, really, where the popularity is the public approval and popularity, you know, measured in opinion polls, is much lower. At the time, the amount of support for the invasion was fairly high. Later, I have some notes on approval ratings and so forth. George W. Bush was doing very well at that time. His approval rating, of course, was at an all-time high after September 11th, which would be explained by a rally effect and a second rally effect with the invasion of the wars. And I think both Fox and CNN were aware that there was, in some sense, an atmosphere of overall, you know, the idea that you needed to support the troops, and Saddam Hussein was a very demonizable villain, and so forth, created an atmosphere in which might explain the relative, perhaps, lack of difference in coverage between CNN and Fox, even though we might perceive them as more ideologically polarized now, and obviously with MSNBC. Do you think we tend to forget those feelings as the war wears on? Is there a war weariness that makes us forget what those initial emotions were like? And of course, we don't go back and look at the coverage. You know, you don't see montages of those early days of the invasion much. Is that just we'd prefer to forget? And what do you think's happening there?
Yeah, I mean, well, it's a few things. One is that the idea that, you know, the news is so ephemeral. News coverage isn't supposed to be rewatched or archived. It's something that, well, the news cycle, that day's news cycle is over with. Let's just forget that. Interestingly, I mean, in popular discourse, at least, you know, something like things like The Daily Show and The Colbert Report exist primarily by rewatching the news and kind of sustaining this memory of what, you know, the big news networks have done. But then there's also, you know, compassion fatigue, right? War fatigue, and this idea that, you know, the public gets tired.
Right.
You know, whether you believe that or not, or whether you think that that's just the networks actually steering the agenda in a different way, not allowing the public to actually, get a sense of what's really happening. I mean, yeah. You know.
Well, and that's probably a topic for another investigation. I do remember, though, I think it's accurate that the expectation going into the 2008 election would be that the war on terror and security and so forth would be a major issue, mm-hmm. and would position McCain as someone who would do very well on those issues. When the economy tanked, you know, that quickly, you know, the main... The main agenda item became the economy, and we really didn't hear much about, we didn't hear as much about, as we might have, and I'm speculating here, about both Iraq and especially Afghanistan, since Obama was really promoting that as a sounder military alternative and really sort of the good war that we should have won in the first place. Mm-hmm. That's now coming back on the agenda, obviously, and I do want to get to that as after we talk about the book. So in chapter two, you talk about the war narrative. So simple question, what was, at least in these 5 days, what was the narrative?
The narrative was quite simple, and it's unfortunately something that people have forgotten a bit. Just the idea that, you know, the U.S. was exacting revenge for September 11th, and how Saddam Hussein was brought into that was quite a feat of narrative mastery on the part of the Bush administration. But essentially, that's what it was. It was a narrative of revenge.
So, of course, we need to recall that there was a complex series of events that led up to the war. Discussions within the administration that we've learned more about now, obviously disagreements certainly leading up to the presentations at the UN and so forth, mm-hmm. the idea of weapons of mass destruction, all these types of things. You know, now we have hindsight to sort of color that. So are you saying the revenge narrative, whether it was crafted specifically by the Bush administration or not, was either picked up or created by both CNN and Fox?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the Defense Department briefings, mm-hmm. And you look at what's being said on the news at that time, there's a very easy kind of one-way flow, mm-hmm. there that's reinforced, obviously. Well, that's, you know, was put out there by Victoria Clark, mm-hmm. Who, you know, did PR basically for the Defense Department, promoted and facilitated by the quote-unquote military advisors, you know, the retired generals and such that went on the news and, you know, took up quite a bit of time on the news defending the position of the Bush administration and framing things not in terms of anything too complicated. They framed things in terms of that narrative and in terms of technology as well. It was all kind of fetishization of the weaponry and you know, geography and all of these things. Look at what we're doing with, mm-hmm. what we have.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think we still hear, you know, echoes of that. I don't recall where I heard this, but, you know, either Bush or administration officials, you know, being talked to, you know, now that their administration is done, saying, well, I still think it was a good thing that we got rid of Saddam Hussein, something that could be salvaged as a, you know, a positive from the war, mm-hmm. As it still, you know, is continuing on in a different way, shape, and form. One sort of side note, in this chapter, you deal with sort of a theoretical controversy about whether news is a narrative. And I think one idea of news is that it's not really. It's just sort of an objective, you know, picture or a reporting of facts that's not narratively constrained. Other theorists think it's very much a narrative. And then I think I saw sort of a middle view in there, which is that perhaps at the micro level of individual stories, it may be that journalists or producers or whoever are crafting individual stories that they may feel are less constrained by narrative than by the actual facts and events of that story, but that when these are summed together and especially strung out in a linear way over time, that a narrative emerges essentially. So first, I don't know if that's an accurate picture of, that's sort of how I read that. What's your view on, you know, the status of news as narrative, as a story.
When I think, or when we talk about television news in particular, folks have a tendency to just want to impose journalistic ideals on that conversation, essentially. But and they, I mean, in the process, they remove the television aspect of it. Within the logic of television, everything is narrative. Pardon me. There's no such thing as non-narrative television, even though there's, you know, unscripted television and whatnot. Everything subsists on narrative. So if you, you know, if you watch even just an hour of the news, and I'm not talking about the, you know, the prime time opinion shows,
right,
but, you know, the daytime shows like CNN Newsroom and whatnot, you know, they have teasers, they have previously ons, recaps and whatnot.
Yeah.
So they use the exact same strategies. And for that, I mean, if you're following one story and how it's covered, you know, over time, you're going to have to really take a look at weeks of coverage and how one news story develops. Looking at war coverage was really advantageous in that there was a very specific period of time, intensive period of time, where they were crafting this narrative. And you could see, I mean, if you were indeed watching it 24 hours a day, you could see how this crafting was taking place. It wasn't by accident. It wasn't something that emerged naturally. It was something that was being constructed right in front of our eyes as CNN and Fox News pieced together the narrative that the DOD was throwing at them, and as they were, you know, narrativizing their own footage.
Now, you also talk, and I may have lost my place where it's in the book, but the notion of using pool coverage, press pool coverage, by the DOD to essentially organize and structure how independently owned media would have access to events and so forth. So, so you've talked about sort of a linear flow from DOD to CNN or Fox in that case. How effective was the press pool concept and later embedding and other types of things? How effective were these in making that happen, in your opinion?
Well, the press pool coverage was, I mean, that was incredibly restricted in a certain way, in a way that, you know, embedding, everybody thought embedding was going to fix that problem, right? But it was restricted in yet another way. It was this weird kind of restriction within freedom. It was very, very interesting that everybody believed that these reporters were going to, you know, be able to be in the action, not just stuck in a room in another country. They were going to be there, and that way they'd be able to report the truth, whatever that's supposed to mean. That absolutely was not the case, as we heard, you know, from journalists even, who were quite frankly ashamed at what they were sucked into. The idea that, you know, yeah, they were there with the troops, but they were basically being brought to an area and told what to point their cameras at, and they wound up joining in that same fetishization of what the military was doing and the fetishization of military technology. So it was almost exactly the same as being in a room in another country and having, you know, the military tell you what happened. Basically, you're there with the military. They're still telling you what happened.
Yeah, your book also points out that the what we now call the embedding of reporters is not exactly a new concept, going back to
World War II.
World War II, right? Different, same new wine, old bottles. I'm not sure what that that phrase is. Let me then push ahead here. I think one of the slogans we all remember is shock and awe. You know, at least it sticks in my mind. Shock and awe, shock and awe. You watch that coverage. How much did that? How big should that? How big of a historical role should that have in our remembrance of at least those 5 days of coverage?
It should play a huge role, actually, in the sense that yes, it was a very abbreviated kind of bombing campaign, but the way that CNN and Fox News built the tension, you know, built up the tension prior to shock and awe, and their almost palpable disappointment at how they felt it was, you know, anticlimactic was just, I mean, stunning in the fact that it was horrible. It was, you can just look back on that and say, wow, they were really enjoying watching it as though it were a snuff film. They were so dazzled by the display of explosions. And some of them were actually, you know, let down by the fact that this, you know, didn't occur to the degree they thought it would. It wasn't as long as they thought it would. So just the way in which the personalities on CNN and Fox News framed it and the way they responded to it, you know, that I think is absolutely something we should take away from that, in addition to the extreme violence, obviously.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's a pretty tough accusation, you know, saying that the anchors or in-studio personalities were you know, the idea first of creating a narrative tension would be very consistent with what a good story would require, you know, a sort of buildup of suspense or what have you. I think a good portion of listeners would be disturbed or concerned about the assertion that the anchors or other commentators were literally disappointed and expressing that. Are you saying that they were, is this something you think they were doing subconsciously, semi-consciously, or very literally?
Quite literally, actually. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't, not everyone was doing this, right. But I have some quotes in the book from some Fox News anchors where, they, you know, they just, you know, weren't as thrilled as they thought they would be. And, you know, I have to hand it to CNN. They actually did consider the difficult position of the Iraqi civilians,
right.
You know, at different points. Although, you know, they were right there with Fox News in building up this and basically creating their own teasers,
right.
You know, for what was to come. You know, Fox News was, I believe it was Brit Hume, actually, who was, you know, well, you know, it wasn't what we expected. Essentially. And so, you know, that's not something that I had to impose upon the coverage at all. It was right there.
Okay. Interesting. So in the third chapter, you introduce the notion of intertextuality, mm-hmm. In relation to how the coverage was framed and sold and so forth. So first off, what is intertextuality?
Intertextuality, in a nutshell, is just this idea that, you know, one text references another. And this can be done in many different ways. It can be through homage. It can be through what's called radical eclecticism, with something like The Simpsons, you know, that references about 20 different other texts without giving credit, without,
right.
You know, paying homage. And you can do it ironically. You can do it, you know, earnestly, et cetera. So, what the coverage was doing a lot was referencing other, interestingly, texts. They would reference other wars, but typically these were wars as understood in the popular imagination. No kind of detailed historical analysis or anything, obviously. But they would reference other kind of easily understood moments. They would reference movies. They would reference movie stars. They would reference genres, all of these different things in order to, you know, make the war easier to consume, basically, make it easier to understand.
So the assumption would be that audience members would have a store of accessible references to other stories, media products, and so forth, and that if news coverage can rely on these, it essentially allows for them to structure the narrative in a way that's more easily understood. Is that the point?
Yeah, basically.
Right. So do you have any examples of sort of an intertextual reference that might make sense to folks?
Sure. I mean, for instance, referencing World War II.
Right.
And World War II movies,
mm-hmm.
To accentuate the idea of a good war versus a bad war, a justified war versus a quagmire, which is what they used Vietnam often as. They would reference Hollywood stars like Bruce Willis as, you know, men's men, pro-troops kind of guys. But they would reference, you know, Martin Sheen. And again, this isn't Martin Sheen the person. This is Martin Sheen the text, basically, the star.
You mean from Apocalypse Now?
No, they would reference his anti-war activities.
Oh, okay, sorry.
Yeah, and so it was, you know, they would obviously pick and choose, but they relied a lot on these you know, preconceived notions of what kind of Hollywood star represents what kind of masculinity. And that masculinity was linked to pro-war or anti-war sentiments. So typically the more macho the star, the more pro-war. The more intellectual the star, the more anti-war.
Right. Okay. You also talk in this chapter about genres and stars. So the intertextuality plays into the genre here. The notion of, I guess, a World War II movie, for instance, in the classic Hollywood vein, that would represent a genre that could be accessed by producers either consciously or unconsciously in some way, shape, or form, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have examples of that stick in your mind, either from CNN or Fox?
Well, for World War II movies in particular, I believe they reference John Wayne quite a bit.
Yep.
And with John Wayne, you can access both the World War II movies.
Yep.
Vietnam movies and westerns,
yeah.
And so he
covers them all.
Yeah, basically, and he represents the same kind of masculinity throughout.
Right.
So you know, they would kind of use stars in movies interchangeably, and then of course, you know, they'd use more recent movies as well, like Black Hawk Down, for instance.
Yeah. So when you talk about stars in this chapter, you're talking about stars, intertextual stars, in the sense of archetypal. Folks like John Wayne or Bruce Willis, as you mentioned, because in the next chapter you get into characters in the narrative itself, right?
Mm-hmm.
These are the people who then play. And correct me if I'm wrong here. It seems that in your fourth chapter, when you're getting into characters, heroes, and villains, and so forth, is it your idea that the folks who play the character roles in the actual narrative are drawing some of their character attributes from the genres and stars that you talk about in chapter three? Is that essentially how it works?
Well, it's really about how the news or how CNN and Fox News were constructing these people as characters, as character types. We don't necessarily naturally fall into these, but this was just another way that, you know, CNN and Fox News were trying to construct this coverage and to make everything fit into this narrative. Not everything was fitting, and so at many different points they would kind of paper over contradictions and, you know, basically cracks in the cohesion of the narrative in order to make everything fit. And one of these ways was through character types, constructing people as heroes and villains and sidekicks and false heroes.
Mm-hmm.
They certainly were constructing their own stars as well. In different ways.
So it's probably, I'm sure listeners could at this point figure out on their own, but in terms of heroes, at least during the first 5 days, who are the heroes in the coverage?
The soldiers, definitely.
Yep.
That was a constant. Bush was constructed as a hero, the kind of strong, silent type. They did some interesting maneuvering, even though he was at Camp David. They emphasized, you know, that his father had done the same thing,
right.
And that Bush was a delegator. He was leaving things to his generals, and that he would not ignore the homeland.
Right.
So they were doing an interesting job of that. The embeds, I believe I talk about the embedded reporters as well, as being stars and being heroes. They were the news equivalent, basically, of the soldiers.
Right.
So they were constructing them in a really interesting way as well.
Right. Another classic role is the sidekick.
Mm-hmm.
So who do we have as sidekicks?
The embeds actually also played the role of the sidekick.
Yeah.
they were you know, fighting the good fight for the news, but they were also the kind of hangers-on to the soldiers.
Right. The villain, I think, is easily identified, at least the major villain.
Absolutely, Saddam Hussein. And then we had the Iraqi information minister, who played a very, very interesting role.
Tariq Aziz?
Mohammed al-Sayed.
Yeah, he was the ambassador.
Right.
Yeah,
so. The Iraqi information minister, was constructed as such a colorful character, and every time he came on, at least the Fox News people had an enormous amount of fun with him because they, you know, automatically discredited him, as, you know, you would really any military figure mm-hmm. on television giving some kind of information.
You also talk about false heroes. Mm-hmm. Who would false heroes be in this?
The false heroes, this was one of the really interesting things that I wasn't anticipating. Mm-hmm. And it just kind of came out of the coverage and the analysis. Folks like the anti-war protesters, mm-hmm. for instance. I mean, we talk about how much coverage, you know, CNN and Fox News have given the Tea Party protesters. Mm-hmm. They didn't really give the anti-war protesters very much coverage at all. But they were there. Some folks have said that they were completely ignored, but that wasn't the case at all.
Right.
They were there. They were just handled differently. Fox News painted them as false heroes because they said they were operating in the service of democracy. They said they were, you know, exercising their right to free speech and whatever. But Fox News said, no, they're anti-troops. They're being funded by communists, et cetera. So even though the protesters, Fox News was saying this, even though they're holding themselves up as, bastions of democracy and whatnot, they're actually operating against the security of the country. So they were painting them as terrorists, basically.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And I noticed in talking about false heroes, you referenced the work of Vladimir Propp. Mm-hmm. Who in the 20s talked about, in analyzing Russian fairy tales, essentially put forth the argument that they all had really the same storyline. Mm-hmm. So there would always be, a hero and someone who would help the hero. And there would, the notion of false hero, that kind of character is found in Prop, as you point out. I'm wondering if you think that conclusions like Props, this idea that there really is sort of a universal or archetypal narrative, in his case for fairy tales, do you think there is a universal, and maybe perhaps not universal, but at least archetypal narrative for war coverage, at least in the U.S. context?
I think in mainstream commercial journalism, mm-hmm. In mainstream commercial television journalism, yes. But, I mean, if you were listening to alternative sources of news at the time, the coverage was radically different. So there's nothing natural about narrative in and mm-hmm. of itself, and there's certainly nothing natural about how war is covered.
Right.
It just depends on where you're coming from, where your money is coming from, who your listeners are, who your watchers are.
Right. Okay. So thanks. It's an interesting observation there. In your fifth chapter, you talk about the look and sound, this hearkening back to the movie posters and how the movie will look and so forth. I think we now all know and expect that CNN and Fox and NBC and any news will be highly stylized with graphic elements and so forth, whether it's, news, weather forecasts or what have you. It's all a huge component of how the station promotes itself and puts forth its image. What would be some specific examples from those 5 days of coverage that stood out to you, particularly in relationship to creating a high concept feel?
I think the animation mm-hmm. that both CNN and Fox News used was really spectacular in that sense. CNN actually used more animation than Fox News. They had these little animated sequences where they would, trace the flight of a particular kind of missile or whatnot. And there was one in which I believe it was a bunker buster, this animated sequence in which it penetrates a warehouse or something.
Yeah.
And we see a cross-section of that warehouse. And once it penetrates the lower level, you see not typical explosions of with gray smoke, but you see green smoke. And mm-hmm. so that automatically implies that there are chemical weapons there. And so, they didn't have to say it. It was embedded in the animation itself. So that, was reaffirming basically this narrative, the idea that, that the U.S. is exacting revenge, but also that we need to go in there to find the weapons, et cetera. Both CNN and Fox News also used what were called baseball cards, these little sequences that would describe the types of weapons that were being used, give you, you know, details about, you know, their capacities and whatnot. And that contributed to this overall very dangerous fetishization of the military technology, which was part of the marketable concept, actually. This idea that the U.S. military using the most sophisticated technology would go in selflessly and you know, free the Iraqis and whatnot. So that was just one component.
So, fill me in a baseball card in the sense that there would be stats on the,
yeah,
you know, that type of thing.
Yeah, that's why they called them baseball cards. Yeah,
interesting. The audio portion interests me. We were talking before the broadcast about how I'll listen to CNN on my radio, on satellite radio, and the sound transitions. This is not war coverage specifically, but when they move from one thing to another. Sometimes it shocks me. I'll be driving along, and you'll hear a very big and a very bassy, you know, very low rumbling sort of, you know, kind of sound to transition to their next story. What about the audio aspects during the war?
It was really fascinating to pay attention to. So many people neglect sound.
Right.
I mean, they just they're overwhelmed by the images. They don't really pay attention to the role that sound plays. I think one of the most one of the greatest examples I found of the use of sound was the use of sound as a teaser. Actually, you know, ambient sound coming from jets taking off, and I believe Fox News did this specifically. We would hear the sound of jets taking off or bombers actually taking off from the UK, and they would say, okay, you listen to those, you know, in 6 hours they're going to be in Baghdad, you know, and you know, we'll carry that live, you know, when they drop their bombs. So they were using the sound again to fetishize the technology, but also as a teaser of, you know, the violence to come, essentially. And then you have the typical kinds of sounds that, you know, that Fox News has been really adept at employing, you know, getting us back into the room to pay attention, because, you know, a lot of people think that news, like soap opera, for instance, is a genre of distraction. So you're a distracted viewer, essentially, when you're watching it, and you need that audio to bring you back, to let you know when something important is happening.
Right. I also seem to recall, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, there were specific music packages and so forth for the actual invasion. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, CNN's music, it was like a prepackaged set of music that they used, and Fox News specifically commissioned their own music, and it was initially going to be a really kind of guitar-heavy or electric guitar-heavy kind of riff, but they toned it down a little bit. But it was very militaristic in its tone. CNN, it was militaristic with a little bit of heavy metal thrown in.
On Fox?
Yeah, on Fox News. And CNN's was, you know, a bit militaristic, but it became softer.
So John Philip Sousa plus Metallica.
Basically.
I'm going high concept here with you.
Basically, essentially.
Yeah, interesting. Well, that leads to sort of some of your final chapters, and you talk about the actual marketing of the war itself and how CNN and Fox marketed the war. What do you have in mind here? What are some examples of essentially marketing or selling the war as really an economic? We talked about the economic, your concept that economics is driving high concepts. So what in essence was the economic effectiveness of this for them in terms of marketing?
Well, there were a couple of ways in which marketing took place. And obviously, when you're talking about television news, you can't talk about marketing and merchandising in necessarily the same way. But it manifested differently. So when CNN and Fox News would do their own promos that would take place, obviously, during the commercial breaks, they would use footage, you know, from the embedded reporters. They would play up the style of the coverage, play up the technology, the weaponry, the soldiers, et cetera, and cut this together in a very quick way so that it resembled a commercial, basically. So there was that conflation of, you know, the news itself and the aesthetics of advertising, essentially. It showed in the ratings. I mean, the one way to kind of quantify how successful CNN and Fox News were was to look at the ratings, and they both enjoyed quite a huge spike, although Fox News consistently beat CNN. In terms of how in terms of kind of marketing and merchandising in the larger sense, we need to think about how the narrative of the war, you know, trickled out into merchandise that operated kind of independently, obviously, of the news. Mm-hmm. But we can relate the abundance of war toys, for instance, and the sales of war-related toys. We can relate that to the narrative that the news was propagating. So it's it all, you know, without the hammering home of that narrative constantly on CNN and Fox News, would we have had these, you know, dolls of the Iraqi information minister? Would we have had, you know, these action figures of George Bush in his, you know, fighter pilot outfit?
Mission accomplished.
Exactly. Exactly.
You mentioned earlier that at the beginning there were no commercials on on CNN or Fox. When did they come back?
They came back around day three, actually. And, you know, I took note of all the commercials, and there wasn't quite any space to insert this into the book at any point, but I thought one of the really, really interesting commercials that kept popping up was for lawn care, a lawn care product.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, this was, I mean, because obviously commercials during wartime or during war coverage, it's a very kind of sticky area.
Sure.
You don't want, you know, advertisers don't want to offend anyone. Advertisers might not want to be associated with war coverage, so you have very kind of neutral products, right? A lot of telecom ads and these lawn care products that kept coming up, and I was like, what is the deal with these lawn care products? And then I was thinking, okay, Iraq, desert, we're seeing all this sand on television, but in the commercial breaks, we're seeing these products to help you get greener lawns. That's what I meant by this interesting exchange that's happening between the text and the commercials.
So it was, but it was about 3 days where the networks felt that they really couldn't touch commercials at all.
It was about two. And basically, this was decided beforehand.
Right.
You know, advertisers, you know, didn't want to be there, you know, during,
right,
obviously, shock and awe or these kinds of things where you might be seeing really offensive images, essentially.
Well, right. And we should recall that it's not as if it was an invasion that just occurred one day. There was a long run-up to it.
Absolutely.
And so
they had to have their meetings with their advertisers.
So clearly, the CNN and Fox were planning for this, just as the U.S. government was. Now it's post invasion. The Iraq war has really morphed into something different.
Mm-hmm.
We're engaged in a different, an escalation of sorts in Afghanistan. And of course, CNN and Fox are still on the scene. We talked beforehand that you've, of course, been watching news. So first of all, what are your impressions of you know, if you were to write a book of CNN and Fox coverage after, you know, the, let's say after Bush's proclamation of the end of combat operations, what are your impressions of how coverage changed in the years following that?
Well, I mean, once the narrative dissolved,
mm-hmm,
once it was no longer this coherent kind of flag-waving, you know, heavily controlled thing, I mean, how do you keep up coverage in the same way that you were doing before? I mean, I don't know the term to describe it. It just, I think the title of that chapter is the coverage fizzles, right, or the narrative fizzles. It just,
mm-hmm,
seemed to fizzle out, and the focus shifted. It became a policy issue. It wasn't about, you know, boots on the ground anymore.
Well, your concluding chapter title is, the narrative exits screenwrite, the coverage fizzles, and news is what? Exactly, ?
Exactly. And so, basically, what I was trying to do there is just talk about how, you know, once the simplicity of the narrative is revealed to be completely false, you can't have that same kind of coverage. And so you just move on to different things. Obviously, the war doesn't go away, so you have to cover it in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
So you just shift focus, essentially, and you're not dealing with embedded reporters anymore. You're dealing with, domestic policy and whatnot in relation to the war. So it just, I think I included a ranking there of the top news stories of, it might have been 2006 or 2007, and you know, Anna Nicole Smith was up there.
And I think we can all understand.
Yeah.
pretty important.
And the Iraq War was pretty far down.
Well, that in itself is, I mean, as we record this, and I am your typical distracted news viewer. Mm-hmm. You know, when I go home and watch news, I'm reading the paper or I'm reading a book or doing a crossword puzzle. But the endless coverage of Tiger Woods mm-hmm. today, you know, these days, it's tough to avoid. And, you know, I don't want to be holier than thou, but when we have issues like healthcare to think about and so forth, the endless references to Tiger Woods, it is interesting, but, you know, it's, and so you raising the name Anna and Nicole Smith, there's always somebody there mm-hmm. to, if we don't have a high concept narrative that's policy related, we have plenty that are, you know, celebrity driven or so forth. Mm-hmm. But here's a question I'd like to pose. I don't know the answer myself. I think that, you know, this is really, you know, an ongoing research question, if nothing else. In the way we've talked about and how you framed CNN and Fox's coverage of this particular portion of the war, the first 5 days of the invasion, I think you've said for a variety of reasons that the narrative itself was high concept. That is, you know, look, hook, and book are all, you know, easily packageable. They were also congruent with what the administration would have wanted, right? Mm-hmm. So in that sense, you know, they were playing along with the game. When that narrative collapses, as you said, it doesn't hold together anymore. The narrative, you know, doesn't have a satisfying conclusion. We don't find weapons of mass destruction. We do get Saddam Hussein, but that doesn't really seem to be enough, right? You've said one thing, first of all, which is that much less attention is then devoted to the war. But when attention is devoted to the war and that high concept narrative is not there, and let's say CNN starts to include more, deal more with negative aspects, right? Do you think that, and especially in relation to what we said earlier about your ideas of economic concentration and so forth, when CNN turns away from it quantitatively but starts to focus on more negative aspects, are they now being driven by different narrative considerations in that case? Are what I'm really trying to get at is that in the case where it seemed as if their coverage was highly congruent with what the administration wanted, is that because that's what was the best story, right? Mm-hmm. And now that the story it doesn't fit so much with what the administration wants. Will, you know, does that show that they're perhaps less ideologically driven than that whole 5 day period might have suggested? I hope that's not too complicated.
No, it's a really interesting question. And I don't by any means think that they start covering more negative aspects because they've suddenly become radical.
Right.
You know, I don't agree with that at all. I mean, even Bill O'Reilly apologized for, you know, mm-hmm. Because I think he said this early on. He says, if they don't find weapons of mass destruction, you know, I will publicly apologize for, you know, beating the war drums. And he actually did.
Yeah.
So it was just a matter of leaving that, as you said, that kind of second rallying effect, right? This
yes.
idea of rallying around the flag and whatnot. Getting past that euphoria and taking a look at things more realistically. At the same time, as I said before, the coverage was in no way, you know, post, you know, mission accomplished coverage was in no way a radical shift in the other direction. I mean, the story very much became about, you know, well, how are the Iraqis now going to fix their own country? It was, again,
right.
somehow removing culpability from the U.S.
Right.
and saying, well, now, you know, you guys really need to come in and fix this, you know. And it's like, well, hello. They, you know.
And, of course, there were spikes of sort of, I think, what the administration would have seen as positive news. The purple thumb images mm-hmm. that we had from the voting
mm-hmm.
Strike me as one mm-hmm. particular point. And the how the surge has been was constructed, another issue that would be interesting to discuss
mm-hmm.
as well. In terms of, what do you think now about coverage in Afghanistan? Any lessons learned from Iraq?
It's, you know, this would have been the story, the narrative that would have made the most sense in 2003, and they didn't go with that.
You mean going back to 2001?
Yeah, exactly. If you're going to weave that narrative, then Afghanistan would have been the place to rest it on, essentially. And Obama said, well, this was the just war. Everybody says, well, this is the just war, and you can take that or leave it. A lot of people don't agree with that.
Right.
If you're going to hang your hat on something, it would have been on Afghanistan at that time. Now the situation has just been, it's too complex to contain within that kind of simple narrative. So we're not seeing the same kind of coherent coverage that we saw back then. The way it's framed is really interesting. What I've seen, at least, it's been framed in terms of Obama.
Mm-hmm.
We're not dealing necessarily with what's happening on the ground. It's
right.
Obama, and it's just about, you know, these very emotional stories about, you know, the troops having to leave for Christmas and
right.
whatnot. They're obviously trying to frame it in these kind of easily understood ways, but it's not as kick-ass a narrative, right?
Right.
As it would have been in 2003.
So one thing that just popped into my head, and I want to remind listeners, is our previous podcast episode where we interviewed Andrew Hayes and Teresa Myers from Ohio State would be of interest if this topic interests you. We in that episode we talked about the effect of coverage of casualties on public opinion and support for the war, where they do find an interesting effect that, it, just quickly summarizing, local experiencing troop casualties in your local area and news coverage of that is negatively related to support for the war. And we, of course, know that support for the war in Iraq declined, and Bush's own personal popularity obviously plummeted from the, you know, from his 70, close to 80% approval rating in the period you're talking about, getting down to about 30 when he left office. So it raises a media effects question, and something perhaps I know your book is not about mm-hmm. the effect of this on the audiences per se. It's more a look at the actual coverage, but perhaps we can speculate about it if we were to take this kind of master narrative that you've portrayed, where there was there seemingly a very coherent, simple, as you say, high concept narrative that was easily that anyone could follow, but the story did not have the proper ending. It is then followed by apparently a long period of disjointed and lesser coverage of a variety of issues related to the war. Do you think then that might explain, in essence, the public sort of concluding, oh, well, this is, you know, whether it's a quagmire or not, it becomes less of an attractive enterprise. I think the core question is here, do we necessarily need news channels such as CNN and Fox giving us lots of negative coverage, or as you say, going radical or something mm-hmm. like that, to somehow convince people that they were not in support of the war anymore? Or is it enough just to have a turning away from very high expectations to something much more sort of, you know, unclear and unfocused? What are your thoughts on that?
I don't know. I think when it becomes something that doesn't have a predetermined ending, this is going to change some minds, I think. The thing about the narrative in 2003 was that a very clear beginning, middle, and ending were crafted ahead of time, regardless of whether or not that was actually going to pan out. People were looking forward to an end, and Bush imposed an end, even though that clearly wasn't the case. So when you have just this idea of an open-ended engagement, even though, you know, folks will set deadlines and whatnot, without that trajectory that hooks people, there's going to be a departure of the audience, you know, on television. And then, you know, as we see as we start to see casualties on television as well.
I think
that's definitely something that's very interesting. Obviously, it was not allowed during the Bush administration, and that Obama went and met the caskets that were returning home. That was quite telling in terms of, you know, the news putting it out there. So I think that, you know, the pull of narrative is something that, and seriality is something so vital to television and to pleasure and enjoyment and a sustained audience, that when you dismantle that, be it with war or be it with healthcare or whatnot, it's easy to assume that people aren't going to stay with it.
Right. And so that's really speculation on my part, you know, trying to deconstruct after the fact the media role in the decline in support is a topic on its own. Well, Deb, thanks very much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you. Very
interesting discussion. The title of Deb's book, Ugly War, Pretty Package, How CNN and Fox News Made the Invasion of Iraq High Concept, published by Indiana University Press, and I assume it's available in electronic bookstores and maybe even brick-and-mortar bookstores everywhere.
Maybe even.
Yeah, if there are any left. So check out Amazon or wherever you purchase books for this one. Any interesting work coming up in the future that we might look for from you?
Possibly less political, but still interesting.
Okay. That's tantalizing and a high concept of its own. Is that the hook or the... that's a good hook for the end of the show. Deb, thanks very much for coming on. It was nice to have you.
Thank you, Jim. I appreciate it.
I'd just like to remind listeners that the Communication Research Podcast is a production of Communication Research Center. If for more information about the Communication Research Center, please go to our website, www.bu.edu/com/CRC. You'll find information on the podcast and information on members of the center, including Professor Jaramillo, and other activities of the center. Also, our podcast is available on iTunes. Go to the podcast directory in the search window, type Communication Research Podcast. You'll find us there. Thanks once again for listening. Bye-bye.